originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is indeed Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Happy to have you with us for the next hour. And for those of you tuning in on Sirius 219 XM 206, welcome to the program. For everybody joining us worldwide on your computer or mobile device on our website, horseracingradio.net, happy to have you along as well. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four. We are coming to you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. And JT, you know, one of the neat things about this program is that there are always new stories to be told. And when we think about some of the trainers we had on when we first started the show, all the way back in 2012, at that point, we were just having them on for 30 minutes at a time. So what would happen is they'd start telling us a story of how they got started in the game and some of the people that helped them along the way. And all of a sudden the show would be over, their time slot would be finished, and we hadn't even talked about any of the horses. So it's nice to have those folks back on the program for an extended visit, and we can spend a little time talking about some of the top horses too.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus a lot of things happen over the course of 5 years in horse racing. So it's good to get an update and hear about what's been going on recently.
Well, tonight's guest has had an awful lot of things happening recently. He is trainer Ken McPeak, and he did first join us on this show in 2012, but again, only for a short 25 or 30 minute interview. Tonight, we'll spend an hour with Ken McPeak, and he is somebody who was born in Arkansas, but make no mistake, Ken McPeak was raised right here in the bluegrass in Lexington, and he does bleed blue, as they say in the Commonwealth. He has a degree from the University of Kentucky in business finance, but has made a living mastering the art of winning horse races. Now with more than 1,500 career winners and purse earnings topping $72 million. Ken McPeak, welcome to the program, my friend.
Thanks for having me, Gus.
$72 million in purses. Dinner's on you at Saratoga when we come up there next week.
Okay. If you say so.
Well, he's got a better shot with you than he does Larry Colmus, I'll tell you that much.
Well, Kenny, like I mentioned, we didn't focus on the horses. We'll do that here in a little bit. We'll talk about some of the top horses that you've had the privilege to come through your program. But start by recapping the story of how you got started in thoroughbred racing. I believe it goes back to your grandfather who took you to the races here at Keeneland.
Well, the long version is that and since we have an hour, my grandmother and my grandfather used to argue over who I went to church with. And so my grandmother was smart enough to figure out that I loved horses. So she would promise me that she would bring ponies to the house after church. And so we would obviously attend church, and then she would fix brunch, and then we would ride all afternoon. And so the granddad lost that one. So then granddad would take me to Keeneland. And so I got the best of both worlds. I got to ride with grandma, and I got to go to the races with granddad. And then my father subsequently taught me how to read a pedigree by the time I was probably 11 or 12. And I found that extremely interesting. He was smart enough to say, when you look at a horse, then you got to ask yourself, who's he by and who's he out of and what kind of crosses. And he taught me the female, the sire lines and the broodmare sire lines at a young age. So the foundation of all that has led me to a career that's been great. And it's something I do enjoy. It's not an easy career sometimes. It's sometimes very difficult. It's more difficult in Saratoga. But anyway, But anyway, we're here and we're grinding along.
Was your dad in the horse business, or was he just somebody that enjoyed the sport?
You know, his heart was in the horse business, but his business was a builder developer, and so his business really struggled during the mid '80s. He had a really hard time. For those that remember, interest rates were in the 18%, 16, 18, 20% in the mid '80s, which almost killed or pretty much killed anybody that was in the building business. And he really struggled during that period. And the horses that he had in training, he was really unable to pay his bills at that time. To be honest, he really had a hard time. And he asked me after I had gone through UK to help him out a little bit. But that's another part of the story.
I can imagine that he had to be proud when you decided to make that move and become a horse trainer.
You know, it really wasn't actually out of choice. It was one of those things where, oh, that looks like that might be fun. I can't say that I consciously sat down and said, I want to be a horse trainer. I knew that I loved the business. The classic story is that I went to UK and I finished my last class at the University of Kentucky. And I had a great group of guys that I was rooming with at the time. And they threw a little party for me, and we had, you know, the kegs of beer and other party favors, and we had a really great time. And about 4:05 in the morning, I was sitting on a sofa with a good friend of mine today, even today, a guy named Ronnie Long. And I said to Ronnie, I said, wow, I've got to get a job now. And he says, well, what do you love? And I said, oh, that's easy. I love horse racing. And he pat me on the shoulder and he said, well, good, do it. I'm going to go to bed. And I sat there and I thought to myself, wow, you know, that's probably one of the best advice I've ever been given. And I went into my room. I grabbed an army jacket, a ball cap, pair of boots, and stumbled to Keeneland, still drunk, and got a hot walking job at Keeneland.
Wow. That's crazy. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was the best educated hot walker, new hot walker on the ground. And my mother was pissed off. I mean, she was so mad. I said, Mom, I'm just going to do it for a little while. You know, it seems like it'd be fun. And, I don't know. I want to see how it goes. And she didn't want anything to do with it. Nothing whatsoever. And I really only did it for about 6 weeks. I worked the Keeneland meet, and then I worked part of the Churchill meet, and then went back to Lexington. I was commuting from Lexington to Louisville for the Churchill meet. Was brutal to be there, you know, by 4:30 in the morning, and then wasn't making enough money to hardly pay the gas bill, and then decided that, okay, I'm going to go back to maybe pursuing what my degree was. And then my father called one day and said, this was in June, the next summer. He said, why don't you help me out, take care of these horses till I can figure out how to sell them. This was during the downturn in the economy in 1985. And I said, sure, I'll help you out, but only for a couple of weeks, Dad, because I got a real job here. And so a couple of weeks turned into a couple of months, which turned into a career. And I'm still doing it.
You know, it's amazing the way this game kind of gets in your blood. And I think that's a story that we've heard from several trainers. It's a story that we've heard from several other people that are in the sport. Maybe not training horses, Kenny, but even for myself, 20-some-odd years ago, I packed up, came down here from Massachusetts to Kentucky, didn't know a soul, but I just knew that I had to be involved in the sport on some level. And it's amazing the way it gets in your blood like that.
Yeah, there's no doubt. The first winter that I had, I won a small race at River Downs in the fall of '85, and it was a complete rush. I mean, it wasn't the money. It's never been about the money. It's been about the thrill of it all. And for people that don't understand, you know, the feeling of winning a horse race and being fully connected to it, having whether you groom the horse or rode the horse or picked the horse at auction, trained, owned, all the levels of the connection, it's just an incredible feeling. And it's a it's hard to get too. It's not easy to do. So, I think that's what's really the hook of it all is the thrill of it all.
Did you go from taking care of your dad's horses right back into the business, or did you go back to your regular job for a while?
Well, he had some modestly priced horses. When I say that cheap, one he gave $1,000 for, one he gave $3,000 for, another one was running for $10,000. Another one was, she was basically a 20 climber, and I was just supposed to take care of him until he figured out how to sell them. And then we borrowed a saddle from the guy next to us because after a week, couldn't sell them. You couldn't sell anything then because the economy was so bad. And then so started galloping them every day. And then we had one that he bred that was unbroke. So we had to teach her to take a bit in her mouth. And so I'd work with him every day, and I just loved it. I mean, it was a hot summer, and it was a lot of hard work. But something I started to enjoy. And then after a while, I told him, I said, well, we need to run this one or run that one. Or, I mean, we had a couple that were ready to go, but they were Ellis Park type horses. And so the trainer next to us, he agreed to run them in his name, but he was going to get the commission, the 10% commission. So that went on for a month. And here I was doing all the work, and this guy was making all the money. And I said, well, there is something really wrong with this situation here. And then I said to my dad, I said, look, either somebody needs to get a trainer's license. So he says he was going to get his trainer's license. I said, well, okay, well, go get it. Go get it. I mean, and so he made arrangements to go get the trainer's license. And then he decided he wasn't ready. And I said, well, then if you're not going to get it, I'll go get it. So I went out and got it. And then went on and ended up winning a nice list of races for him. I mean, nothing major. We were running at Latonia. We ran at Latonia the whole winter. Came into, in the fall, won the race at River Downs. Won another little race at Churchill. Stayed the winter at Latonia. And by the next spring and into the summer, some people started asking me to take horses for them.
How long did it take your mom to warm up to the idea of you being a trainer?
About 2 years. She didn't like it at all. And I'm not, financially it was a real struggle. I was having a hard time making ends meet. I was basically, jumping apartment to apartment, anybody let me stay with them. Cash flow was bad because, anything that we earned was, my father needed it to pay bills, and I was the last to get paid. And then about 2 years into it, after I started winning for some other clients, she said, can you get me Derby tickets? And I said, well, let me check. So I pulled a favor or two at Churchill and got her some nice Derby tickets, and then after that she started to warm up to it.
Yeah, it's funny how moms are like that. My mom hated it too when I became a trainer, but after I won a couple races, one day I overheard her tell one of her friends, well, Jude's been winning races at Santa Anita, and then I knew she was hooked on it. But I don't think she ever really warmed up to it the whole time she was alive, but she at least tolerated it, which made it a lot easier to deal with.
Yeah, my mom was she was a financial advisor in Lexington, and she taught me a lot of valuable lessons about dealing with people. And the truth is that we're horse advisors here, and it is an asset, and it has to be managed somewhat like an asset. And it's not not a whole lot any different than a high risk Wall Street investment, except it's it's obviously blood stock, not stock. And she'd always tell me, she said, son, you're going to get hired and you're going to get fired. The key is getting hired more than you get fired. Okay. And you'll be okay. And then she'd say, listen, clients have the choice. There are a lot of different brokers and there are a lot of different trainers, and they have the option to try all of them, and it's okay. And, you know, do your best for them. Should work hard for those that want you. Don't put too much energy into those that don't. And you know, you don't have to get mad when they leave. Just beat them when you run against them. It's okay.
That's great. Don't you think that the business side is often overlooked when a trainer starts out?
You know, the business side is the most difficult part of it. I think horses are really easy. I'm glad you brought that up because it's a really good topic. You know, it's really the financial side of this is brutal. By the time a trainer sits down and does the math on his workman's comp, his payroll, his hay, straw, feed, trying to make ends meet at this, people that survive at this for 10, 20, 30 years are good at a lot of things, not only horses, but dealing with people and business. And it's something that I would emphasize to young horsemen that, hey, you know, don't think you're going to walk in here and just because you know a little something about a horse, there's a whole lot more to it. And I think guys can make it to a certain level. And I went through the pain of going from 3 horses to 10 and then 10 to 20 and then having to deal with 30 and then 50 and 70. And so your level of management skill and your level of dealing with so many different issues, it's really challenged the higher up you go, and to make it to a certain point is just really tough. And it's even today, it's not easy.
Yeah. A lot of times it's your money on the line for a long time. You take a horse at the beginning of the month, you pay the grooms and all that for that whole month, and you send your bill out, and then the owner doesn't pay you till the end of the following month. You've got $6,000 to $8,000 into a horse before you ever see a dime.
Well, one of the things that I think the sport fails in is that we need financial responsibility rule from the top down. You know, I could sit on this call right now and I could list you about 20 owners who just flat refused to pay me. And that would probably be mean of me and certainly wouldn't be appropriate, but they're out there. And then the bad thing about it is that when you're a young trainer, you deal with those type of people that say, I'm not going to pay you. Well, wait a second. You know, I worked hard for you. It wasn't my fault your horse is slow. It wasn't my fault. Okay, but yeah, horse might have bowed a tendon, or horse maybe not be able to breathe, or yes, it may have broken down, and those things are terrible. But it's for a young trainer that, you know, for someone to stiff them out of significant amount of money, and I'm going to tell you, I got stiffed out of a lot of money when I was in my first 10 years in business. I mean, people that just wouldn't pay. I mean, and on the lower end, the guys in this sport, and it's not necessarily the upper end where I am now. It's at the lower end where the guys that are stable, that the Belterras or the Mahonings or Finger Lakes or these secondary BZC tracks that really fight every day. They get a really small day rate, and they probably got a guy that's going to beat them out of it. And there are serial guys that move around and don't pay trainers, and that has to end. And if the sport's going to gain respectability, you have to support the guy on the bottom more than the guy on the top. And so that's just maybe one of my beefs about things that they need to take care of. There's a financial responsibility rule. And when a man doesn't pay his bills from an owner down, then that has to be addressed, and to be addressed strong with iron fist.
Talking with trainer Ken McPeak here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kenny, isn't that a situation, though, where the word starts to get out and spread about people like that aren't paying their bills? And at some point, you know, who's going to take on that type of owner if you know you're not going to get paid?
No, it doesn't spread. It doesn't spread well enough. And it's, you know, there are too many guys that are hungry for horses that will take someone like that. But, you know, we don't need to dwell on the negativity of things like that. But it is just one. It's just one issue, and it certainly needs to be addressed.
I think first and last,
the racing commissions need to deal with.
Right.
I think first and last would really help that. When you rent an apartment, it's first and last. I think you should have to put first and last in the paymaster's account when you send somebody a horse. That's how I would deal.
Well, it would be more ideal, but we are kind of a trusting business in that sense, and it is unusual. But boarding, and typically in this day and age, I don't have a problem. But there's got to be a better way. But I do think that if you address an owner's license for financial responsibility for non-payment immediately, and there was a record kept of that, then that would be good. Some racing commissions don't want to deal with it, and that's just unfortunate. They should deal with it. If a trainer doesn't pay, they deal with it. But if an owner doesn't pay the trainer, they don't deal with it.
Kenny, you talked about some of the...
That doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense at all. You talked about some of the early struggles that you went through as you were kind of getting started in the business and some of the obstacles that you had to overcome. Was there ever a time when you're going through all of that and you're not making any money and you're working so hard, was there ever a time when Ken McPeak said, you know what, maybe this isn't the right decision, maybe I should go do something else?
Not particularly. Probably the biggest struggle I ever had in my career was, I'll be honest, I'll bring it up. I had a horse breakdown in New Jersey in 1993. I'd only been training 8 years, and there was a big controversy whether I should have run the horse or shouldn't run the horse. And this was during the Gopher Juan had broken down, and there was a big push on breakdowns. But it was a series of circumstances that to this day that I don't think I could have done a lot about. The steward stuck me in the race. It was an off the turf race. There were six horses stuck in the race. I didn't want to run. My owner wanted to run. I pushed back. The steward stuck me. I told the jock, don't let her, just hold her together. Don't just get her around there safe. She breaks her leg, and they suspended me 30 days over it, saying that I shouldn't have run her. She had issues, and I knew what they were, but I thought that they were, I'd actually been running her with issues. But as a claiming trainer, you have to run horses with issues. I mean, that's just part of the game. Are they doing better trying to make sure those issues keep from breakdowns? They try, but it's never easy. But I got down to three horses at one point, and then the next season, at that point, I was pretty low. I was thinking, I don't know. I mean, but the next season, I came up with Tejano Run, and Tejano Run took me to a level that I was able to get away from the claiming horses. And claiming horses, guys that do that for a living, tip your hat to them, because that is really hard work. It's really difficult, and there's a certain art to it. And you cannot have any fear. You deal with horses with long lists of issues, and you walk the line on what issue you can deal with and what issue you can't. And I'll admit that when I was a claiming trainer, I played that game hard, and you have to, or you can't be scared. And but at the same time, I was looking forward to getting into young horses, and then Tejano Run came along and changed the trajectory of my career.
What's the story, Kenny, of Tejano Run? How did he come into your care?
Well, after that filly had gotten injured at Monmouth, I basically, drew a line in the sand with all my clients. I said, look, I'm done claiming horses. I'm not going to – it's young horses or nothing at all for me. I'm going to go to yearling sales, and I'm going to go to two-year-old and training sales, and if you're with me, great, and if you're not, I'm okay with it. And so I had to recreate myself, no different than an artist or whatever. You have a next stage, and I went to recreating my career, and I said, okay, young horses. And so Roy Monroe up to that point had been a client who had dabbled a little bit in the game, but not much. Ray Cottrell was another gentleman who's still a close friend of mine, and someone I care deeply about, lives outside Louisville. But between Roy and Ray, they supported me with a small amount of young horses. And I told them, I'd like to go to the yearling sale. I don't care what the budget is. Even if it's just small amount, I want to buy young horses, and I want to develop young horses. And that's what I want to do from here on out. And those two guys gave me a nice little opportunity. And I bought Roy Monroe Tejano Run in a group of yearlings. Modest amount of money, spent 20 grand for the horse. And we bought 8 out of the group. 7 of them were claiming horses, average. And then the one ends up being a millionaire.
Yeah, a millionaire and a millionaire that could really run. Took you to the Kentucky Derby, ran that bang-up race in the Derby. Only a couple minutes left, Kenny, before we have to get to our next commercial break or our only commercial break here on the program. But what made Tejano Run so good?
You know, this horse was just big and strong and massive, and he had a great body on him. You know, he was a horse that had I'd call the right parts in the right places, and he was just extremely fast for a big horse. He just, you know, even to this day, might be one of the most physical horses I ever had my hands on, and I'd love to have another one like him, and I may have. So anyway, just he was a standout.
When did you first know that he could really run?
You know, we got him into actually, you know, well, I'll extend the story. So we had him in Ocala, and Tony Everard was getting the horse ready. And out of the group, Tony wasn't all that impressed by him. He was a big leggy horse. And Tony said, yeah, this one you could probably run through the two-year-old in training sale, and you might double your money. And so we kind of contemplated that. And then we never nominated him, so he ends up coming into Kentucky in the spring to me. And I worked him at Keeneland a couple times. I just worked him a half mile, a couple halves, and I think he didn't even break 50. It was just a couple of mediocre works, and we didn't really get into him either. And so Tony had already gotten him his gate card. So we enter him, and I named Jerry Bailey to ride. And Jerry, he leaves the gate, and he's 14 lengths off the pace at the quarter pole, and Jerry rolls the stick over and hits him twice, and he wins by 2. And Jerry comes back, his eyes as big as the moon, say, he gets off, he says, wherever he's going, I'm going. And so he bucks shins in the race, and so after he bucks shins, of course, we've got to address that. And we take him to a local farm, and he's over there for a couple of weeks getting his shins addressed, and he colics. And so he ends up having a colic surgery that almost, I mean, would kill most horses. Not only does he overcome the colic surgery, he's back to racing. He runs second in the cradle in September in his second start.
Wow. Yeah.
And then after that, he wins the Turfway or the Turfway Juvenile. He wins the Breeders' Futurity, and then he's third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Colts. I mean, amazingly physical colt.
Yeah, the sensational racehorse, too. Came back with that bang-up, runner-up performance in the Kentucky Derby in 1995, and a horse that could really, really run. We're going to get to a break. We'll come back, continue our visit with trainer Kenny McPeak right here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Stay with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Selected sales, superior results. Success starts at Saratoga, the number one ranked yearling sale in North America by percentage of grade one winners, graded stakes winners, and stakes winners from horses sold. Top graduates include Songbird, Stellar Wind, Teppan, Avenge, and Taprit, the fourth Belmont stakes winner in the last 6 years to be sold at Saratoga. The Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, August 7th and 8th in Saratoga Springs, New York. Where will you be? At Millridge, their focus is always on raising and selling racehorses. Millridge is offering 5 yearlings at the upcoming Saratoga sale by leading sires Quality Road, Flatter, Kitten's Joy, Street Sense, and More Than Ready, each with a strong dam side providing every opportunity to raise a racehorse. Since 2005, Millridge has sold 53 yearlings at the Saratoga sale with 60% winners. 7.5% are grade 1 or grade 2 winners, 16% graded placed, and 24% stakes placed. Learn more by visiting millridge.com.
Bloom Racing, Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Kentucky Downs kicks off a unique five-day all-grass race meet in September. Live racing September 3rd, 8th, 10th, 11th, and 15th. And the stakes are high with $7.8 million in purses over the 5 days, an average of $1.56 million each day. Kentucky Breds will run for maiden special weight purses of $130,000 and allowance purses of $145,000. Maidens not bred in Kentucky will compete for $58,000 with top allowance for non-Kentucky Breds at $67,000. Learn more at KentuckyDowns.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross O'Brien, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And War Emblem is toiling as they turn for home. Medaglia d'Oro, Sunday break. Sarava has come on through to take the lead. And War Emblem has given way. No triple crown for the 24th year. Here comes Sarava and Medaglia d'Oro, though, striding to the line together. Sarava on the outside. Medaglia d'Oro toward the rail. They're coming down to the finish. A huge upset is looming here under the line. Sarava has won the biggest long shot in the history of the Belmont Stakes at 70-1. Medaglia d'Oro was finishing second there. And farther back, Sunday break. And a huge disappointment today for War Emblem.
That's Tom Durkin with the call of the 2002 Belmont Stakes. Sarava, trained by our guest here on Trainer Talk tonight, Ken McPeak, pulling off the biggest upset in the history of the Belmont Stakes and denying War Emblem that chance at a triple crown. We're going to continue our visit with Ken McPeak momentarily, right after we remind you that if you did miss any portion of this program, you can head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and by the way, on our channel on the Horse Races Now app, which is, of course, the app that is designed by our good friend Ken McPeak. Kenny, welcome back, my friend.
That was a fun finish call there again. I've heard that a thousand times.
Yeah, I figured that would bring back some good memories, though.
I mix emotions about that, to be honest.
Yeah? How come?
That was the last time that I ran the horse. And I ran him four times, had two wins and 2 seconds, and then they moved him to Baffert.
Oh.
And Bob used to call me and say, how did you win with this horse?
What would you
he
tell
would.
Him?
He would call me, and I would say, Bob, you will be in the Hall of Fame way before me. All right? I said, look, I mean, he had issues. The horse had a little issue here, a little issue there, little stuff, but we figured him out pretty good. And then but Bob was really frustrated. He ran him eight times. He never ran better than fourth. And actually, I'm kind of proud of that.
Yeah, that's a pretty good record, huh?
Yeah,
you should be proud of that. Kenny, I can imagine that's the other aspect of training horses that makes it so difficult. You do everything you can. You win a classic race with a horse like Sarava, and then the horse is taken away from you through no fault of your own. That has to be very difficult.
Yeah, it was complicated. The horse had come out of the Belmont fine, and we did some shoeing changes. We changed blacksmiths on him, and then when we did that, then he had some. The angles were different, and he wasn't quite comfortable, and our next step wasn't easy because of that, and it was kind of an unusual situation. And I don't shoe horses, so you certainly couldn't say, I mean, why that happened. But anyway, when we changed the angles on the shoeing, it really ruined the way he moved, and we had to wait on him to come back around. But Bruce Scott was shoeing the horse prior to that, and, man, he had some serious foot issues going into his three-year-old year, which we did get sorted out. And then, you know, look, he ran great on a big, big day, and it was great fun winning that race. I still, you know, just real – it was a timing issue, and Prado certainly nailed it, and he beat Medaglia d'Oro, which, you know, of course – ends up being a great stallion. And if you'd asked me if that would be my only classic winner up to that point today, and here we are 15 years later, I would have said, no way. I mean, I've been third in the Belmont and third in the Preakness recently. We knocked on the door and lists of Breeders' Cup races. But Travers' win with Golden Ticket Dead Heating was certainly – that's a classic, isn't it?
It's a classic. We were there that day. We broadcast the race, and it was one of the more thrilling finishes that we've had the privilege to be part of. Yeah, take me back to that day, and tell me about that race.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about that one was is that the horse was entered in a – I entered him in an allowance race, and we were going to run him a other than allowance race coming off a bit of a layoff, and he had been training gangbusters. And so I enter him in the allowance race. I can't remember what date exactly it was, a couple days before the Travers. And I had nominated him to the Travers as a backup, which was smart. So I enter him, and they had a main track only allowance race. The same A was A other than that there were six MTOs, and it starts raining an hour before scratch time. And so they call the race off the turf and saw all the MTOs jump into the off the turf race, which killed the book race that I was going in. And so the race doesn't fill. So I call the owner up and I said, Carter, we've got a dilemma. You know, I was scheduled to run Golden Ticket in that allowance race this weekend, but the race didn't fill because of rain, and we don't have many choices, but I'd like to run the horse in the Travers. And he says, well, what's the Travers? he's a new owner, right? I said, well, Travers, is this a really nice race they run up here? And I think the horse has got a legitimate chance. I said, I don't think it's that tough of a race. I said, but we're going to be long shot. And I said, the horse is just trained and fantastic, and I think he'll beat the other horse that I'm running, which was Attigan, who was third in the Belmont the month before. And he says, well, if you want to run him in the Travers, run him in the Travers, whatever the Travers is.
So, what's it like? So you said it was a steeplechase.
Yeah. So they jump on the plane and they fly to New York, and they come in for the Travers, and they were just joking around, you know, like whatever this was. So anyway, and then the horse ends up winning in a dead heat with Karen McLaughlin, who Karen and I had known each other since being kids in Lexington. And Karen's a year older than me, but we both grew up on the south side of Lexington. And when the horses hit the wire together, we were standing on the when they were waiting to post the photo, we were standing on the first level of the stairs going down to the winner's circle, and we're looking at each other going, what do you think? And I said, I'm going to be sick if I'm second. And he says, I'm going to be sick if I'm second, because we had already both been second in the Travers prior to that. I had had Repent, who had been second. And then when they posted the numbers and then Dead Heat, we looked at each other and go, wow, and then clapped high fives. That was a pretty cool moment. You know, two Lexington boys come to New York and Dead Heat in a race like that. And it was just a really fun day. And, you know, you just never know in this game. It's such a humbling sport and can be so much fun when it works your way. And that was just one of those days where you won't ever forget it.
Yeah, it was really cool. And then the following year, the canoe painted 50-50. That was really cool, too. That had to be a great reminder every time you went to the races at Saratoga looking at that canoe out there.
Yeah, and you got to name one of the foals by either Alpha or Golden Ticket needs to be named Two Canoes, right?
That's right.
And they both stand here in New York, and they compete for mayors, too, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, it's a great story and a great moment in the career of Ken McPeak, who joins us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.
You know, when we brought you back from the break, Mike mentioned the Horse Races Now app, and we have a fan. Her name's Julie. She's from Barbados, and she absolutely loves our show, but it sounds like she might like your app better. She sent me a tweet the other day. It said, "You have to introduce me to the creator of the Horse Races Now. I want to give him a hug and a kiss. This app is like gold to me." So I just wanted to let you know that there are people that really appreciate the Horse Races Now app. My daughter is among the big fans of the app, too.
It's the most important thing that I've ever done inside the sport. You all, I don't know if you all know, we're pushing 600,000 downloads in 203 countries. We're getting ready to be able to take wagers inside the app. It's been financially very difficult. It's actually stretched both, you know, my business. We've been funding it, trying to get it off, you know, off cash flow negative into cash flow positive. But it gets 10,000 new users every 30 days.
Wow.
I mean, what in horse racing is getting 10,000 new users every 30 days? I don't understand why we're not getting more industry support. We would like to have more support from the Churchills and the Stronics and even NYRA. I mean, Roberts Communications could do a better job supporting us. Equibase has been fantastic. The Jockey Club has been fantastic. There's a long list of racetracks out there that are on board with what we're doing. And, you know, this is something that when this thing, with a marketing budget, we feel like we'll have 10 to 15 million people on it worldwide. And we are in the process of adding European racing may come on in the next month, where you'll be able to get all the European push notifications, et cetera, on it, all the information. You're going to be able to wager through it, and hopefully worldwide. We've got plans to put in not only Australian racing, Hong Kong, Japan, even South American racing in the long term. And so we've really got some momentum. It's been one of the most difficult things I've ever done, but it is it's a big deal. We've got to figure a way to grow this sport as opposed to it contracting and getting smaller with an aging fan base. And we've heard it for so long. There are people out there that love the game. We need to connect better, and that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, and if you go to the app and you download the app, if you don't already have it, it is Horse Races Now. You can download it as we're talking. It's very, very quick to do, very easy, and you can watch live racing on your phone. It's one click. You can watch live racing, and you can go back and watch replays. You can get results. You can see entries. There's a channel page on there, which we are part of. We've been part of that for a very, very long time. You can click on the HRN channel, and you can listen to our programming and listen to archives of Trainer Talk and other programs. Kenny, it's just, to me, it's somewhat mind-boggling that there would be a kickback from other organizations in this sport, because this is an app that is so good for the sport. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. What's the main objection you get when you approach these other companies?
Well, we're classic disruptive technology. We're going against the grain of other entities. Typically today, if you want to watch a horse race, you either have to download a racing app or an ADW app, which if you're not the correct age or in the incorrect state or you don't have a credit card, you can't register for that.
Right.
And then the TVG obviously does good work, but if you don't have satellite TV or your cable subscriber doesn't have it, then you're not going to get it there. So the barriers that the industry's put in place for people to be able to watch racing are so difficult that we're doing it to ourselves, in that the sport doesn't make it easy for fans to watch. And what we're trying to do is to change that. We're trying to open that up, and that we want to, instead of instead of watching a race being behind a pay box or a subscription, we're putting it outside of it and saying, here, yeah, go ahead and watch. And, yeah, by the way, if you want to get to know the sport better, yeah, we're glad to help teach you. That's counter to what everyone else is wanting to do. And, you know, for example, Churchill really wants people to go to TwinSpires to watch their races. But if you don't want to use TwinSpires, you can't watch the races on 20 or 30 other ADWs, which is, it's bad for the sport. Stronach Group, although they are saying that they're coming on, we've got verbal commitment that they're coming, and we're really excited about that. Timmy Ritvo is a really big help with that. He understands it. He gets it. We want to promote each and every racetrack. It doesn't matter to us whether it's a Stronach track or Churchill track or a Naira track or English track or an Irish track or wherever it may be in the world. Our goal is to aggregate them all, show them to fans, and then, oh, by the way, if you'd like to bet, you can, or if you want to check stats, or if you want to not miss this race. It's all about the experience. And then we want to socialize it so that, let's say, you know, Bob Baffert has X amount of followers. If he chooses, he can communicate with those followers on Horse Races Now eventually. Or if, you know, Todd Pletcher or Chad Brown or Kenny McPeak or whomever, or even jockeys want to say, yeah, my horse in the third race had a bad trip, or, you know, those types of things are going to be available. When you socialize it like that, it's going to be a real game changer too.
Ken McPeak, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Again, the app is Horse Races Now, and you can download it and learn more about that app. Check it out now. We would highly encourage it. Kenny, back to the horses for a minute here. We talked about Sarava in 2002 winning the Belmont Stakes, but that year, I mean, that was also the same year that you had Harlan's Holiday win the Florida Derby, which, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that was your first Grade 1 win, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. Yeah, I'd knocked on the door on a few of them, but I hadn't won one. And then Take Charge Lady ramped up a couple of more, and Repent won the Louisiana Derby, which was Grade 2. He was a really nice horse, and Sarava knocks out the Belmont. So yeah, that was a great season.
What does that mean for a trainer to win a Grade 1 race?
You know, that's one of those deals that it's so hard to do. You just don't realize how hard it is to do believe it or not, I've not won a Breeders' Cup race. I've been second and third in 15 Breeders' Cup races without a win. And so that just explaining how hard it is. Getting those kind of horses is difficult, but not even just doing it once, but to come back and do it again and again and again, you know, and having longevity doing it, it takes not only a depth of talent, but certainly clients and the type of horses that it takes to do it. And I was lucky that, you know, guys like Jack Wolf gave me an opportunity back then, and some others. And I was, certainly at a stage where I was prepared to do it. Tahana Run had sniffed at it, but he hadn't won one for me. But they're those kind of horses are just golden and real pleasure to have. And it's they're hard to get, really hard to get.
Yeah, they are hard to get. And I think part of that is the relationships with clients. They don't last as long these days as they used to. It's a very transient business. It's a what have you done for me lately kind of thing.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I probably put more emphasis in on trying to win stake races as opposed to my win percentage. I know that a lot of guys spend time saying, oh, my win ratio, rate or all that. I think win rate's not really important. I think that developing a horse and actually winning a graded stake race is a real feather in the cap. And sometimes you have to stick your neck out to do that. And you have to test those horses at levels we talked about them. Sarava 70-1, Golden Ticket 30-1. I mean, you can't be scared. Wayne Lucas is the greatest at it. He has never been scared to run a horse at a price ever. Is that hard on your win percentage? Yeah. But truth is it doesn't really matter. And I think win percentage hurts the starts per horse per year, and it hurts the racing office, because the racing office doesn't get enough starters, because guys are worried too much about their win rate. So sometimes you just need to run them and find out.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's the first thing a new client looks at when he tries to find a trainer is the standings, you know, and that's all well and good. But in the meantime, there might be somebody that suits you better as far as your philosophy in racing and what you want to do. I always say it's like, you know, trying to find a girlfriend or a boyfriend. You know, you have to, you know, maybe check these people out a little bit before you make a long-term commitment.
I ran a horse last week or week before then in the Indiana Derby that I went over there really confident that this horse could be third or fourth without much trouble. And he ended up running quite poorly, which I was a little mud on my face. But I felt like that the horse, if he runs third, he makes 50,000. If he runs fourth, he makes 25. I really felt really confident that he could do that. And, of course, it didn't happen. But that's the risk you take. And then you regroup and say, okay, now it's time to be conservative with him. We tried something difficult, and he didn't do what we thought he could do. And so now we're going to regroup and find out. We'll ease him back up. So it's all a matter of approach. And everybody's got their style. I certainly never been scared. And, you know, to run Golden Ticket as an A other than and the Travers, you know, we share a great story because I took a chance.
Well, you mentioned winning big races and somewhat winning the right races, so to speak. I'll put it that way. One horse that you talked about a short time ago, Take Charge Lady, she won a lot of the right races, including several grade ones. What made her so special?
You know, she just would breathe special air, that filly, from the beginning. She was just really rapid fast. She only made one start sprinting in her career, and that was at Keeneland as a two-year-old. And then I realized that she was so fast that if I sprinted her too much, that I felt like I was going to have a hard time holding her together physically. And then she was the antithesis of these others. Every time I let her over there, she seemed like she was 6-5, 8-5, 4-5. Those are great. That's great fun. I mean, especially when they win, it's a lot of pressure when they get beat, but she didn't get beat very much. Probably the greatest race she ever ran in was when she was second to Zary at Oaklawn. But that filly, I mean, she never lost to Keeneland. Other than, I don't know if Wise Dan passed her in purse money at Keeneland or not. I know American Pharoah did in the one race. But beyond that, she was a really great. She would perform at Keeneland like nothing else. And some say she was the queen of Keeneland, considered one of the best all time. And a great broodmare, too. I mean, what she's done as a broodmare has eclipsed what she was as a racehorse. And so having found her at auction and also being lucky enough to have trained her, you know, she was great. We need another one like her.
How closely will you follow the careers of some of the horses that come through your program after they retire?
It really depends on the situation. You know, actually, even when horses are claimed off of us, I'll follow some of those horses for a couple years on my own app. You know, that's why I made it, so I could follow other horses. But I like to keep track and see how they did and see if anybody made any major improvements on, which is usually really rare. And I do think that's the definition of a great trainer is when a horse changes stables, that they don't do dramatically better when they leave you. But it just depends. I mean, as stallions that I've trained, obviously keep track of them. I usually get breeding rights for most of them. And then even Curlin, who I bought out, I had a breeding right for him, and that ended up being worth a lot of money. Take Charge Lady, every foal she's dropped, I look at the sale. A lot of the fillies that I've had over my career, I like looking at their foals at the sale and trying to get an idea of whether they're producing themselves or reproducing themselves or the sire that they're bred to. Interestingly enough, Take Charge Lady, almost every sire that she was bred to, the foal looks like the stallion, nothing like her. But they've all had class like she did. So you've got to think that she produces or she passes the class and not necessarily the look. So that's been interesting to recognize.
There's so many facets to this business, and your early interest in pedigrees probably spurs a lot of that interest that you have today.
I think it's a big advantage when I'm looking at horses at the sale. I think that there's a rhyme and a reason to the way that horses are made. I think that there's certainly a pattern. A stallion has a certain success look, and you have to pay attention even to when horses are running that you don't train. I love looking at each and every horse in the paddock for every stake race that I'm involved in and ones I'm even not involved in. I'll sit down and watch horse walk by, look at the body, look at the sire, look at the broomer sire, make a mental note, and then take it to the next horse sale and see if I can find something that works too. I mean, it's moving art and motion. I mean, horse racing is literally blood art, and to find that really good horse with that has all the right parts in the right places and the pedigree and all the right crosses. It's interesting stuff. It's really cool.
Just a few minutes left in this program and our visit with trainer Ken McPeak here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Kenny, one thing that we like to do at the end of the show is to let our listeners know a little something about trainers that maybe they don't always get from watching television or from listening to interviews here on the radio. So we've created a segment here at the end of the show. It's five fast facts to know about trainer Ken McPeak. And I'm going to ask you five quick questions, pretty simple, straightforward. You can answer them, and we'll let people know a little bit more about Ken McPeak. So here we go. So the first one, your favorite movie would be?
The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
There we go. How about your favorite ice cream flavor?
Chocolate chip.
Colts or Phillies?
Phillies.
Good answer. Favorite thing to do outside of racing?
Hang out with my daughter, my wife, and just chill.
All right. And the last one, finish this sentence for me. If I wasn't training horses for a living, I would be?
Oh, wow. You know, I don't know the answer to that. I have no idea.
Don't even want to think about it.
Maybe running Parlay Social with Bob Estes.
Great answer. Ken McPeak with us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Kenny, as always, can't thank you enough for the time. You're always very accommodating, my friend, and all the best moving forward. We will look forward to catching up with you here in Saratoga very soon.
The horse you need to think about following is Ten City.
Tent City?
Ten City.
Ten City.
The horse that won the Bashford Manor.
Yep, Ten City.
Let me tell you guys, this might be the best horse I've ever had my hands on.
Ooh. Wow. There's some good information.
Bold statement.
This horse is a beast.
Ten City. Are we guaranteeing a win on the first Saturday in May right now?
Well, you know. Hey, this is a serious, serious animal. I mean, I think he's got more speed than Tahana Run ever had. He's bigger and stronger than Golden Ticket. Sarava couldn't handle him on any day. He could outwork Senior Investment that ran third in the Preakness right now as a 2-year-old. Ooh. We're waiting for the Iroquois at Churchill. He's going to run Iroquois Breeders Futurity. And if all goes well there, obviously goes to California. But this horse is a monster.
He's on our radar. Ken McPeak with us here on Trainer Talk. Kenny, we appreciate it, my friend. Good luck with Ten City and everybody else.
All right, thanks.
All right. Our thanks to our producer, Lee Delapina, doing a great job for us. Our thanks to our special guest, Ken McPeak. A lot of fun, JT.
Yeah, it was really entertaining.
All right, don't forget we're back next week with an all-new edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast. For Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penn, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.